by the elite. The first error that educated people made was being excessively hawkish back in 1966, 1968, or 1971. The second error they made was in filling out my table. Why have my audiences been so wrong in remembering or deducing who opposed the Vietnam War? One reason is that Americans like to believe that schooling is a good thing. Most Americans tend automatically to equate educated with informed or tolerant. Traditional purveyors of social studies and American history seize upon precisely this belief to rationalize their enterprise, claiming that history courses lead to a more enlightened citizenry. The Vietnam exercise suggests the opposite is more likely true. Audiences wouldn't have been so easily fooled if they had only recalled that educated people were and are more likely to be Republicans, while high school dropouts are more likely to be Democrats. Hawkish right-wing Republicans, including the core supporters of Barry Goldwater in 1964, of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and of groups like the John Birch Society, come disproportionately from the most educated and affluent segments of our society, particularly dentists and physicians. So we shouldn't be surprised that education correlates with hawkishness. At the other end of the social status spectrum, although most African Americans, like most whites, initially supported U.S. intervention in Vietnam, blacks were always more questioning and more dovish than whites. And African American leaders, Muhammad Ali, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, were prominent among the early opponents of the war. American history textbooks help perpetrate the archetype of the blindly patriotic hard hat by omitting or understating progressive elements in the working class. Textbooks don't reveal that CIO unions and some working class fraternal associations were open to all, when many chambers of commerce and country clubs were still white-only. Few textbooks tell of organized labor's role in the civil rights movement, including the 1963 March on Washington. Nevertheless, many members of my audience are aware that educated Americans are likely to be Republicans, hardliners on defense, and right-wing extremists. Some members of my audience know about Goldwater voters, Muhammad Ali's induction refusal, Birchers and education, or labor unions and the war. Information that would have helped them fill in the blanks in my table correctly. Somehow, though, they never think to apply such knowledge. Most people fill out the table in a daze without ever using what they know. Their education and their position in society cause them not to think. Such non-thinking occurs most commonly when society is the subject. One of the major duties of an American citizen is to analyze issues and interpret events intelligently, Discovering American History exhorts students. Our textbooks fail miserably at this task. The Vietnam exercise shows how bad the situation really is. Most college students, even high school students, would never put up with such obvious contradictions when thinking about, say, chemistry. When the subject is the social world, however, they are often guilty of nonsensical reasoning. Sociology professors are amazed and depressed at the level of thinking about society displayed each fall by the upper-middle-class students entering their first-year classes. These students cannot use the past to illuminate the present and have no inkling of causation in history, so they cannot think coherently about social life. Extending the terminology of Jules Henry, we might use social stupidity to describe the illogical intellectual process and conclusions that result. Students who have taken more mathematics courses are more proficient in math than other students. The same is true in English, foreign language studies, and almost every other subject. Only in history is stupidity the result of more, not less, schooling. Why do students buy into the mindless analysis they encounter in American history courses? For some students, it is in their ideological interest. Upper-middle-class students are comforted by a view of society that emphasizes schooling as the solution to intolerance, poverty, even perhaps war. Such a rosy view of education and its effects lets them avoid considering the need to make major changes in other institutions. To the degree that this view permeates our society, students automatically think well of education and expect the educated to have seen through the Vietnam War. Moreover, thinking well of education reinforces the ideology we might call American individualism. It leaves intact the archetype image of a society marked by, or at least striving toward, equality of opportunity. Yet precisely to the extent that students believe that equality of opportunity exists, they are encouraged to blame the uneducated for being poor, just as my audiences blame them for being hawks on the war in Vietnam. Americans who are not poor find American individualism a satisfying ideology, for it explains their success in life by laying it at their doorstep. This enables them to feel proud of their success, even if it is modest, rather than somehow ashamed of it. Crediting success to their position in social structure threatens those good feelings. It's much more gratifying to believe that their educational attainments and occupational successes result from ambition and hard work, that their privilege has been earned. To a considerable degree, working-class and lower-class Americans also adopt this prevailing ethic about society and schooling. Often working-class adults in dead-end jobs blame themselves, focusing on their own earlier failure to excel in school, and feel they are inferior in some basic way. Students also have short-term reasons for accepting what teachers and textbooks tell them about the social world in their history and social studies classes, of course. They're going to be tested on it. It is in the student's interest just to learn the material. Arguing takes more energy, doesn't help one's grade, and even violates classroom norms. Moreover, there is a feeling of accomplishment derived from learning something, even something as useless and mindless as the answers to the identification questions that occupy the last two pages of each chapter in most history textbooks. Students can feel frustrated by the ambiguity of real history, the debates among historians, or the challenge of applying ideas from the past to their own lives. They may resist changes in the curriculum, especially if those involve more work or work less clearly structured than simply doing the terms. After years of rote education, students become habituated to it and inexperienced and ineffectual at any other kind of learning. In the long run, however, learning history this way is not really satisfying. History textbooks and most high school history teachers give students no reason to love or appreciate the subject. We must not ignore the abysmal ratings that history courses receive, and we cannot merely exhort students to like history more. But this doesn't mean the sorry state of learning in most history classrooms cannot be changed. Students will start learning history when they see the point of doing so, when it seems interesting and important to them, and when they believe history might relate to their lives and futures. Students will start finding history interesting when their teachers and textbooks stop lying to them. Afterward. The future lies ahead, and what to do about them. Once you have learned how to ask questions, relevant and appropriate and substantial questions, you have learned how to learn, and no one can keep you from learning whatever you want or need to know. Neil Postman and Charles Weingartner. Do not try to satisfy your vanity by teaching a great many things. Awaken people's curiosity. It is enough to open minds. Do not overload them. Anatole France. He is a lover of his country who rebukes and does not excuse its sins. Frederick Douglass. The future of mankind lies waiting for those who will come to understand their lives and take up their responsibilities to all living things. Vine Deloria, Jr. If the authors of American history textbooks took notice of the points made in the first 10 chapters of this book, then textbooks would be far less likely to present, and teachers to teach, distorted and indefensibly incomplete accounts of our past. Lies My Teacher Told Me is itself incomplete, however. It says little about Hispanic history, for example. Yet our textbooks are so Anglo-centric that they might be considered Protestant history. What about women's history and the history of gender in America? Two different but related topics. Lies mentions both subjects from time to time, but makes no thorough critique of how textbooks present women's history and gender issues. And what about the next lie? The next historical marker, commemorative statue, museum exhibit, feature films set in the American past, television miniseries or historical novel will probably pass on more misinformation. At the least, it will present its topic incompletely and partially. What is to be done about these future lies? The answer is not to expand Lies My Teacher Told Me to cover every distortion and error in history as traditionally taught, to say nothing of the future lies yet to be developed. That approach would make me the arbitrator. I, who still unknowingly accept all manner of hoary legends as historical fact. Despite my sincere effort, this book undoubtedly contains important errors and should not simply be presumed true. Surely the answer is for all of us to become, in Postman and Weingartner's vulgar term, crap detectors, independent learners who can sift through arguments and evidence and make reasoned judgments. Then we will have learned how to learn, as Postman and Weingartner put it, and neither a one-sided textbook nor a one-sided critique of textbooks will be able to confuse us. To succeed, schools must help us learn how to ask questions about our society and its history and how to figure out answers for ourselves. At this crucial task, most American history textbooks and courses fail miserably. Part of the problem is with form. Because they try to cover so many things, textbooks, at least as currently incarnated, cannot effectively acquaint students with issues and controversies and thereby with historical argument, with its attendant skills of using logic and marshaling evidence to persuade. Mentioning is part of the problem. Even when textbooks discredit the myths that clog our historical arteries, students don't retain the tiny rebuttals in their history textbooks. They forget the untoward fact that contradicts the myth, for it doesn't fit with the powerful archetype. History textbooks and teachers must make special efforts and take enough time to teach effectively against these archetypes. Mircea Eliade has referred to the inability of collective memory to retain historical events except insofar as it transforms them into archetypes. Truth, to be retained, must be given the same mythic significance that we have given our lies. For this reason, I find myself tongue-tied when teachers ask what textbook I recommend. Perhaps no traditional textbook can be written that will empower rather than bore us with history. What, then, is to be done? The portrait of lying painted in the last two chapters as a vertically integrated industry, including textbook boards, publishers, authors, teachers, students, and the public, may appear bleak. It follows, however, that intervention can occur at any point in the cycle. The next few paragraphs are directed particularly toward teachers, who can intervene even in the absence of transformed textbooks. Those of us not in the classroom can play a role in changing how history is taught by supporting teachers who put innovative approaches into practice. The first critical change must be in the form. We must introduce fewer topics and examine them more thoroughly. There is no way to get students to explore and bring primary and secondary sources to bear on the thousands of topics that now clutter history textbooks. Rather than having students memorize the names Amerigo Vespucci, Giovanni Verrazzano, Ponce de Leon, Hernando de Soto, etc., and a phrase telling what each allegedly did, teachers can help students focus on the larger picture, the effects of Columbus's 1493 expedition upon Haiti and Spain, and then on all the Americas, Europe, the Islamic world, and Africa. So many details connect with major issues such as this that I suspect students will come away remembering more particulars than if they had merely regurgitated factoids. Certainly, students will recall the projects they worked on and the issues they worked through themselves. Many educators have already put into effect teaching methods that deviate from the deadening learn the textbook routine and provide models for other teachers. Covering fewer topics will enable classes to delve into historical controversies. Doing so is an absolute requirement if students are to learn that history is not just answers. The answers one gets depends partly upon the questions one asks, and the questions one asks depend partly upon one's purpose and one's place in social structure. Perhaps not everyone in the classroom will come to the same conclusion. Teachers need to put themselves in the position that for students to disagree with their interpretation is okay, so long as students back up their disagreement with serious historical work. Argumentation based on evidence. Students who research both sides will discover which issues and questions facts will resolve, and which differences involve basic values and assumptions. The students' positions must then be respected. This doesn't imply that teachers should concede the floor, or accede to the now fashionable opinion that all points of view are equally appropriate and none is to be privileged with the label true. Teachers don't have to know everything to facilitate independent student learning. They can act as informed reference librarians, directing children to books, maps, and people who can answer their questions about history. Resources already exist that can help teachers teach history creatively, using primary materials. Perhaps the best resources are right at hand. Students can interview their own family members, diverse people in the community, leaders of local institutions, and older citizens. Some history classes have compiled oral histories of how the Depression affected their town or how desegregation affected their school. Students in a Mississippi high school published a book, Minds Stayed on Freedom, about the civil rights movement in their community. Students in a Massachusetts school became historical figures and published their work. For students to create knowledge is exciting and empowering, even if the product merely gets placed in the school library. Students might also suggest a new historical marker for their school or community. Often the most important events go unrecorded on the landscape, while markers commemorate the 19th century site of the First Presbyterian Church. What events at a high school were important enough to be noted on a marker? Which graduate should be commemorated? Which made history? And is a broader definition of making history needed? Do the names of local streets or buildings honor people whose acts we are now trying to rectify? Mississippi's Ross Barnett Reservoir, for example, pays tribute to the racist governor who tried to keep African Americans out of the University of Mississippi, while Medgar Evers, the state's heroic NAACP leader, murdered because of his efforts on behalf of civil rights, goes remembered mainly by a college named for him in Brooklyn. Who should be honored? Why? How? Raising these questions leads students to important issues. If their answers are controversial, so much the better. Teaching history backwards from the present also grips students' attention. The teacher presents current statistics on high school seniors' life chances, analyzed by race, sex, social class, and region, their prospects for various levels of educational achievement, divorce, incarceration, death by violence, their life expectancy, frequency of voting, etc. Then students are challenged to discuss events and processes in the past that cause these differences. Even if teachers don't challenge textbook doctrine, students and the rest of us are potential sources of change. If that statement seems idealistic, consider that African American students have actively pressured several urban school systems for new curricula. White high school students throng to see revisionist movies about American history, whether by Kevin Costner, Dances with Wolves, or Spike Lee. Not history itself, but traditional American history courses turn students off. Whether we read textbooks, see historical movies, or visit museum exhibits, we must learn how to deal with sources. This process entails putting 5 questions to each work. First, why was it written or painted, etc.? Locate the audience and social structure. Consider what the speaker was trying to accomplish. This is part of what sociologists call the sociology of knowledge approach. English professors call it contextualization, learning about the social context of the text. A second question, also part of the sociology of knowledge approach, is to ask whose viewpoint is presented. Where is the speaker, writer, etc., located in social structure? What interests, material or ideological, does the statement serve? Whose viewpoints are omitted? Students might then attempt to rewrite the story from different viewpoints, thus learning that history is inevitably partial. Third, is the account believable? Does each acting group behave reasonably? As we might, given the same situation and socialization. This approach also requires examining the work for internal contradictions. Does it cohere? Do some of its assertions contradict others? If textbooks emphasize the United States as a generally helpful presence in Latin America, for example, how do they explain anti-Yankee sentiment in the region? Fourth, is the account backed up by other sources? Or do other authors contradict it? This question sends us to the secondary historical and social science literature. Even a cursory encounter with cross-cultural research on social class, for instance, is enough to refute the glowing textbook accounts of America as a land of unparalleled opportunity. Finally, after reading the words or seeing the image, how is one supposed to feel about the America that has been presented? This analysis also includes examining the author's choice of words and images. Most of the words we use in history and everyday speech are like mental depth charges, James Axtell has written. As they descend through our consciousness and detonate, their resonant power is unleashed, showering our understanding with fragments of accumulated meaning and association. Readers who keep these 5 questions in mind will have learned how to learn history. Teachers and students are not the only fulcrums of change. New factors make transformed textbooks possible. In California, Texas, and other states, right-wing conservatives still influence textbook adoptions, but so now do many others. Beginning in 1985, for instance, Texas forced some publishers to treat evolution more honestly, avoid such stereotypical terms as go on the warpath when referring to Native Americans, and add white before Southerners where appropriate. The ensuing standoffs between black nationalists, feminists, right-wingers, First Amendment groups, etc., allow authors and publishers new room to maneuver. Consumers of education, students, teachers, parents, and interested citizens, are beginning to demand textbooks with real flavor, history that can even upset the stomach. According to Michael Wallace, Americans are ready for it. People generally are angry at having been conned and are curious to know more, he claims. Witness the triumph of Roots in a culture once seemingly mired in the pieties of Gone with the Wind. It is about time. For history is central to our ongoing understanding of ourselves and our society. We need to produce Americans of all social class and racial backgrounds, and of both genders who command the power of history. The ability to use one's understanding of the past to inspire and legitimize one's actions in the present. Then the past will seriously inform Americans as individuals and as a nation, instead of serving as a source of weary clichés. Products of successful American history courses know basic social facts about the United States and understand the historical processes that have shaped these facts. They can locate themselves in the social structure, and they know some of the societal and ideological forces that have influenced their lives. Such Americans are ready to become citizens because they understand how to affect change in our society. They know how to check out historical assertions and are suspicious of archetypal truths. They can rebut the charge that history is irrelevant because they realize ways that the past influences the present, including their own present. Thomas Jefferson surely had it right when he urged the teaching of political history so that Americans might learn how to judge for themselves what will secure or endanger their freedom. Citizens who are their own historians, willing to identify lies and distortions, and able to use sources to determine what really went on in the past, become a formidable force for democracy. Hugh Trevor Roper, the Dean of British Historians, has written, "A nation that has lost sight of its history, or is discouraged from the study of it by the desiccating professionalism or unprofessionalism of its historians, is intellectually and perhaps politically amputated. But that history must be true history, in the fullest sense." After the 11 years of research and writing that went into this book, my own quest to know what truly happened in our American past has only begun. After reading all this way, so has yours. Bon voyage to us both.
The End. You've been listening to Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, by James W. Loewen, narrated by Brian Keeler.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.